had been held at Ditchley, the 18th-century Georgian country estate near Oxford, where Winston Churchill spent much of the Second World War. The small, by-invitation-only event had been attended by public policy chiefs from such Silicon Valley companies as Apple and Twitter, senior U.S. policymakers such as Julie Brill, a commissioner at the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, the U.S. government agency supposed to regulate antitrust, and civic activists like Renata Sampson. It had been an intellectually stimulating weekend, with what might be described diplomatically as a frank exchange of views between representatives of the government, private companies, and civic groups. Sampson, in particular, had been openly critical of what she described as the untrustworthy business practices of private companies trying to monetize people's data. I was intrigued as to why Renata Sampson, the head of Big Brother Watch, a non-profit group focused on the protection of online privacy against the prying eyes of both government and private enterprise, would want to introduce me to startup tech entrepreneurs. After all, these insatiably data-hungry monetizers of our personal information were, I'd assumed from what Sampson had said at Ditchley, the very people from whom Big Brother Watch was supposed to be protecting us. As a serial startup entrepreneur myself, I know one thing for sure. There are no original ideas in tech. I'm certain that any original idea I come up with for a startup will have been simultaneously invented by any number of other entrepreneurs around the globe. When the time is right for a new idea, it seems to show up in many people's minds at the same time with a serendipity that appears almost engineered by the gods. So, every startup guy in the mid-90s, including myself, and not just a brilliant young financial analyst with the idea of founding an online bookstore, had the same crazy dream of opening an e-commerce website. 10 years later, many smart geeks, and not just a particularly smart one in a Harvard dorm room, experienced that eureka moment of recognizing that the world needed an online social network. Today, with AI being all the rage in Silicon Valley, venture capitalist friends tell me that they listen to the same pitch for the same "my smart automation startup is going to revolutionize the world" idea all day long. So, it is a little disconcerting when the first startup team members to whom Sampson introduces me explain with breathless excitement that they have the first kind of enriched data business. It's a startup, they boast, that will finally empower individuals to be able to own and control their own data. They are a couple of well-seasoned, middle-aged entrepreneurs. One, a former Asia-based executive at a multinational media company and an angel investor. The other, a partner at an international management consultancy and a former head of research at a big bank. But in their unabashed enthusiasm for their new product, they resemble excited teenagers. These entrepreneurs tell me that the best thing a government can do is provide the regulation that empowers people. Technology has become so cheap, they explained, that there's no need for huge public investment in new products and services. Once a law like the GDPR has been set, we can leave the rest to the private sector. Their startup has Margrethe Vestager's idea of privacy by design at its heart. It is a secure digital locker built from supposedly fail-safe technology, developed by an American defense firm that allows people to securely store their personal online data. Rather than touching, seeing, or holding our personal information, this locker encrypts the data to ensure its security and portability. It had been designed as what its creators call the plumbing of a new post-GDPR data economy, in which privacy has become the new norm and trust its new currency. So, what's Big Brother's position on this? I ask Sampson after the first set of entrepreneurs has left. Well, we've got to trust something, she says. Her point wasn't to fetishize the free market, or the Randian entrepreneur, or any of the other libertarian orthodoxies that usually accompany these kinds of pitches for startups. That something we need to trust, Sampson is saying, is a concrete law, guaranteed by the 28 members of a community of 500 million people, designed around the protection of data. That law, which turns the surveillance economy on its head, is doing Renata Sampson's job for her. It might even make Big Brother Watch redundant. To borrow some words from the former New York Yankees catcher, Yogi Berra, listening to the second entrepreneur, a self-funded former telecom executive, is like deja vu all over again. It feels as if we are back in 1995, and everything is once again possible. He even begins with the same promise of being the first kind of data company to create a product designed for people. He then talks with the same enthusiasm about the importance of the GDPR in the creation of a privacy ecosystem, explaining that his startup would have been unimaginable before this law had been passed. And he ends on the same note too, explaining that what's missing in the current big data economy is trust, and that his product will reestablish trust at the center of the networked world. I'm not sure if either of these businesses will succeed. They might not. As a startup entrepreneur, the other thing I know for sure is that predicting the future of other people's startups is the ultimate crapshoot. This was a pre-Brexit conversation. So by 2018, it's quite possible that these British entrepreneurs will have to relocate their GDPR startups to Brussels, Barcelona, Budapest, or Berlin. But the point is that there are entrepreneurs all over Europe, from Brussels to Barcelona to Budapest to Bristol, all waking up to the same innovative possibilities in a digital economy turned on its head by government legislation. Somebody will succeed at some point with a product that makes privacy the new norm. After all, as Renata Sampson says, nobody wants to be watched in everything he does. Although so much of this reminded me of the landscape back in 1995, there is one critical difference. The first internet revolution was a purely free market affair. Today, however, we are already in Steve Case's third wave, when what he calls the visible hand of government will be central to the success of digital businesses. By 2018, then, it may have become self-evidently clear to everyone, but the most die-hard libertarian, that regulation is indeed innovation. That can only be good news for those of us, like Steve Case or Margrethe Vestager, who want to flatten the winner-take-all landscape and build a fairer world. Not everyone, I'm guessing, will agree that the best way to fix the future is through legislation. There will be those who say that rather than Case's visible hand, it's actually what Adam Smith called the invisible hand of the free market that remains the best guarantor of innovation. Perhaps. To test this theory, let's return to where we began this journey, to the Alte Teppichfabrik, that industrial relic in Berlin, where some of Germany's most innovative free market digital entrepreneurs are attending the encrypted and decentralized conference. Chapter 7. Competitive Innovation. Re-Decentralization. Up on the top floor of the Alte Teppichfabrik, the old Berlin carpet factory with the chic industrial interior and the panoramic views over East Berlin, it's also 1995 all over again. In spite of Edward Snowden's rather apocalyptic warnings from Moscow, the encrypted and decentralized conference is abuzz with a new optimism about the old dream of digital reinvention. The hope is that the paired technologies enabling decentralization and encryption can provide us with what Snowden would call the agency to re-engineer the internet economy. The vision, to borrow a term from the World Wide Web inventor, Tim Berners-Lee, is the re-decentralization of economic power. It's an attempt to return to the original architecture of the web, to a network where power lies on the edge rather than in the center. The conference invitation from Blue Yard Capital had said, "We need to encode our values not just in writing, but in the code and structure of the internet." Those values, however, aren't just ethical. They are also the values of the free market. As the event's keynote speaker, Brad Burnham, the co-founder and managing partner at the New York City-based venture capital firm Union Square Ventures, tells the Berlin audience, "The great thing about capitalism is that it's the only choice." And so, according to Burnham, at least, it's the invisible hand of the market rather than the visible hand of Vestager's EU that can now reinvent the digital economy. "We are now living in a world resembling 1995, Burnham explains. "It's a world of smaller companies, a new age of innovation from below." As I've already suggested, there really aren't any original ideas in tech. Today, it's Berners-Lee's and Burnham's re-decentralization idea that is fast shaping the contemporary tech zeitgeist. To go forward, this idea is saying, we must return to the original principles of the web. To fix the future, we have to go back to 1995. You'll remember there was even a parallel event in the same month as the Berlin Conference, the Decentralized Web Summit at San Francisco's Internet Archive, featuring many of the Internet's original architects, including the inventor Berners-Lee and the TCP/IP creator Vint Cerf. Everyone, it seems, on both sides of the Atlantic is nostalgic for the future. The web's creator looks to reinvent it, as the New York Times described this June 2016 event, which brought together privacy advocates and pioneers of such peer-to-peer technologies as blockchain to discuss a new phase of the Internet. Brewster Kahle, the Internet Archive founder and summit organizer, believes that the time is now right for a radical re-decentralization of digital power. "The future has finally caught up with us," he tells me when I visit him at his office in San Francisco's Inner Richmond District. "Now is the time to finally create a decentralized web," he says, "by building values into the code itself. It's not a trivial task," he says, "but it can be done." I asked Vint Cerf how difficult it was to build the original Internet, Kahle tells me, and Cerf replied, "It took 1 year with a room of 5 or 6 guys." The first time around, Kahle confesses, speaking about the original digital revolution, "We made it too hard for individual creators to get paid for their work." The mistake, he says, is that the web lost the ability to serve its users. "We can do better than this," he insists, "so that it isn't a security decision every time you click on a link, and so that all the online music and videos aren't owned by iTunes." Many other digital pioneers share this vision of re-decentralizing the web. Ethan Zuckerman, the director of the MIT Center for Civic Media, and another key member of the founding generation of Internet geeks, believes that this struggle between the forces of centralization and decentralization has been a familiar feature of the digital economy even as far back as 1993, when there were no online directories for navigating the web. "For old-school cyber-utopians like me, it is extremely disappointing that the Internet is not inherently decentralizing," Zuckerman told me when I visited him at his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. "But it's hard to build the opposite." Like many other idealists, he is critical of the entire ecosystem of today's online economy. He argues that we've become too dependent on the advertising business model that compounds the already exaggerated power of winner-take-all advertising companies like Google, YouTube, or Facebook. "The more we publish, the more dominant these companies become," he says. So rather than technology, the fundamental problem with the web today is its dominant business model. The challenge, then, is the reinvention of Internet economics. It requires us to rethink the whole ecosystem, from the free content and free services to the ubiquitous advertising and surveillance of the digital economy. The primary focus of the Berlin Encrypted and Decentralized Conference was also the imagining of a better digital ecosystem for our networked age. But in contrast with Kahle's and Zuckerman's hopeful visions of what a new Internet might look like, all the talk in Berlin is about a new digital world, a real beta land that is actually coming into existence. Burnham's keynote address, "The Unraveling of Network Effects and Data Lock-ins," is focused on the way in which the latest digital technology is turning the digital clock back to a more innovative age. Network effects and data lock-ins are the very forces that have transformed the open web of the mid-90s into what Tim Berners-Lee bemoans as data silos. Winner-take-all intermediaries like Amazon, YouTube, and Uber. And their unraveling, according to Burnham, is happening because new technologies like blockchain and other web protocols are making these intermediaries, which he describes as centralized data managing services, redundant. It's the end of the digital middleman, Burnham predicts. Goodbye to the networked intermediary. One example of these protocols that Burnham cites in his speech is the open source interplanetary file system, IPFS, designed to establish a permanent and decentralized method of storing and sharing files. Protocols like IPFS are allowing for the online exchange of data between independent players, resulting in the creation of what Burnham calls decentralized marketplaces. Other examples of this are the so-called decentralized autonomous organizations, DAOs, such as the controversial peer-to-peer currencies Bitcoin and Ethereum, which operate on blockchain technology. These networked platforms do away with the need for the middleman, a bank or a government agency. They are returning us to Berners-Lee's original web, a level playing field on which power resides on the edge with its users. After Burnham's speech, I talk with him outside the Alte Teppich Fabrik in a small beer garden overlooking the River Spree. I begin with the same question that I'd asked Gary Reback about history repeating itself, first in 1995, and then now. Raising his beer bottle, Burnham quotes Mark Twain. "History doesn't exactly repeat itself," he answers, "but it rhymes in a perpetual cycle of innovation." In 1995, he explains, the market opened up with the shift from the desktop computer industry, dominated by Microsoft, to a market defined by the web. The business model gradually moved from packaged software to open source technology, a process that in turn gave rise to the Web 2.0 revolution of Google and Facebook. And today, he explains, we are back with a new kind of disruptive technology that is challenging the dominance of the winner-take-all companies of the Web 2.0 revolution. Like Reback, Burnham, whose investments at Union Square Ventures include billion-dollar wins on Tumblr and Twitter, is a critic of monopolies. But in contrast with the antitrust lawyers, Burnham's critique is a purely financial one. Venture capitalists, he explains, have a responsibility to their investors to ensure the biggest returns. Today's digital economy, with its tiny pool of winner-take-all companies, is actually as bad for venture capitalists as it is for everyone else. So the only way to improve the venture business is to figure out what he calls mechanisms for opening up the market again. In this more open future, the companies might be smaller, Burnham acknowledges, but there will be more winners, and so the rewards for professional investors will be higher. So how is this change going to come, I ask. As opposed to Margrethe Vestager's or Gary Reback's, Burnham's faith remains in the free market to fix the problem of these dominant intermediaries. To him, the centralized services managing data are ultimately flawed businesses. He explains that things will become broken when Amazon or Uber increases what he calls its take. So in Uber's case, for example, the change will eventually be triggered by its drivers, who are getting more and more squeezed by the ride-sharing company's increasingly onerous terms. Eventually, presumably, they will be pushed into participating in their own decentralized marketplaces that will compete with Uber. One possible platform for this type of radically new business is a German startup called Slock.it that is building a blockchain-based universal sharing networks which empowers people to bypass central silos like Uber and Airbnb and directly transform their cars into taxis or their houses into hotels. But when, I reply, when should we expect the emergence of that new ecosystem that will return online power to the user? When? That, of course, is the billion-dollar question for a venture capitalist. It's all about timing. It's not even the business model of radical new companies like Slock.it that's critical. After all, Burnham confesses, he invested in Twitter when the short messaging platform had no idea how it would make money. Timing, then, is everything. In the venture capital business, it's always too early until it's too late. It follows a familiar pattern. Burnham explains how massive change in the marketplace happens. Nothing, nothing, nothing. And then something dramatic. At Encrypted and Decentralized, there isn't much evidence of the something dramatic that could change everything. There's certainly a lot of abstract technological talk about distributed cloud systems, blockchain databases, DAOs and IPFSs, and how they all fit together into that ever-elusive stack. But there's little evidence that any of this technology is actually maturing into an ecosystem of easy-to-use products and services that people really want. As so often at cutting-edge technology conferences, it is hard to separate the hype from reality. And all too often, I'm afraid, their only reality turns out to be hype. Then, in the final discussion of the day, there is a panel on sustainable ways of monetizing content. One of the panelists is Tim Schumacher, the co-founder and executive chairman of a Cologne-based company called AdBlock Plus, an open-source app that prevents online advertising from showing up on your web browser. Schumacher is on the panel to discuss his company's new partnership with Flatter, a Swedish-based micro-donation provider. But before describing this deal with Flatter, Schumacher asks the audience for a show of hands about who is using AdBlock Plus's product. Everyone. Absolutely everyone on the top floor of the old Berlin carpet factory raises a hand. They are all using the same disruptive technology that, in Brad Burnham's Age of Innovation from Below, empowers them to block online advertising, the very heart of today's conventional business ecosystem. So they are proving not only that the current business model of the Internet doesn't work, but also that there might be an alternative ecosystem being re-engineered in Germany out of its ruins. Winning the second half. I arranged to meet Schumacher in Cologne's Cathedral Square, the civic space dwarfed by the city's Gothic Dome, Germany's most visited landmark and the largest church in Northern Europe. Constructed predominantly between 1248 and 1473, the Cologne Cathedral, which boasts the largest facade of any church in the world, was finally completed only after the unification of Imperial Germany in 1880. This World Heritage Site, therefore, is a testament not only to Germany's engineering heritage, but also to the country's rich history in the re-engineering of long-term collective projects. This re-engineering culture, while certainly not unique to Germany, is nonetheless a persistent historical feature of Europe's most populous and prosperous country. Germany's economic accomplishments, particularly in the late 19th century, were mostly based on its re-engineering of the earlier haphazard British Industrial Revolution with cutting-edge technology and planned investment in factories, infrastructure, and scientific research. Today, a similar kind of narrative seems to be shaping Germany's unfolding role in the world's digital economy. Does Deutschland do digital? Asks The Economist about the world's leading engineering economy. In 1995, the response would certainly have been no. Today, however, the answer is less clear. As the Deutsche Telekom CEO, Timotheus Höttges, admits, the first half of the battle to master the digital world was lost. So the question now, Höttges says, is how do we win the second half? It's certainly an important question. The German business consultancy group Roland Berger estimates that the German economy will lose 220 billion euros of annual value if it fails to successfully transform itself digitally. Today, only four of the world's 174 unicorns, privately held companies like Uber or Airbnb that have a valuation of more than $1 billion, are German. Every key manufacturing sector, particularly its 361 billion euro automotive industry, which makes up 20% of total German industrial revenue and employs more than 750,000 workers, is now vulnerable to the revolution of the Internet of Things, with its billions of connected devices flooding onto the market each year. 50 billion of these smart things by 2020, according to Cisco, and many more billions throughout the 2020s and 2030s. So what Germans call Industry 4.0, the fourth stage of industrial evolution after water and steam power, mass production, and the information technology revolution, is of vital importance to the future of the world's leading engineering power. Even German Chancellor Angela Merkel speaks regularly about the need to digitalize Germany's Plattformkapitalismus. This period will determine the future strength of the world's leading industrial centers, Merkel said in April 2016, expressing her angst about winning the race to dominate the digital landscape. We have to win this battle. So, how can Germany win the second half of the digital game? The answer probably lies in the country's historical tradition of successfully re-engineering technological revolutions begun elsewhere. As Christoph Kiese, the author of Silicon Germany, notes, Germany's great strength is evolutionary, incremental innovations. So, even in the first half of the digital game, when Germany all but failed to get on the scoreboard, its most notable success lay in the replication of Silicon Valley innovation. The Berlin-based Rocket Internet, founded in 2007 by three brothers, Mark, Oliver, and Alexander Somver, is an industrial-scale incubator of startups that clones models of American e-commerce companies throughout the world, employing 30,000 people in more than 100 companies active in 110 countries. Rocket Internet has a $3 billion market value, essentially based on taking other people's ideas and executing them effectively. The problem with Somver's controversial Rocket Internet is that it's more of a clone factory than a true re-engineering business. For German companies to win the second half, they have to do more than simply take other people's ideas and execute them effectively. The challenge now, as Brad Burnham argued at Encrypted and Decentralized, is to be able to re-engineer entire ecosystems. It's a challenge that, for the typical top-down German engineering firm that still imagines the economy being partitioned into standalone industrial silos, is quite daunting. The LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman quipped that every 21st century company is a technology company. And as a tech company, every company is now, like it or not, in competition with every other tech company. In the automotive industry, for example, one of the most pressing challenges for German car manufacturers is to determine where they will fit in the so-called software stack that will empower self-driving vehicles. In a new ecosystem driven, so to speak, by autonomous cars, their challenge is to avoid becoming the dumb, commodified hardware at the bottom of the stack in an economy where, as you'll remember, Marc Andreessen saying, software is eating the world. So for Mercedes and BMW, the most dangerous long-term competition now comes from Silicon Valley. Their existential threat is that they could be eaten by Google's, Tesla's, or Apple's algorithms, not by Toyota or Ford cars. In 2013, to hoots of condescending laughter from the digital cognoscenti, Angela Merkel, using language she might have borrowed from Moore's Utopia, called the 50-year-old internet Neuland, meaning new land or uncharted territory. And yet, in a sense, Merkel was right. If Germany is to win the second half of the game, the internet needs to once again become uncharted territory. All its orthodoxies need to be challenged. Just as the internet has disrupted old industries, so the time has now come, in the perpetual creative storm of our Schumpeterian capitalist economy, for outsiders to engineer the internet's own disruption. Which brings us back to my meeting with Tim Schumacher in Cathedral Square. We meet in an Italian cafe adjacent to the cathedral. Sadly, this expansive Cologne Square had recently become one of the most notorious places on earth. On the night of December 31st, 2015, there was a riot in which groups of, mostly immigrant men surrounded and then sexually assaulted women who were celebrating the incoming year. And so, along with the kids on bicycles, a flock of Asian tourists, and the yellow T-shirted Hare Krishna people, there's a squadron of blue Polizei cars parked in the middle of the square, guaranteeing order on the cold, blustery spring afternoon. Over tea, the modest, soft-spoken German entrepreneur tells me about a new kind of publishing ecosystem that is emerging on the Internet. Built around disruptive platforms such as Adblock Plus, the Swedish content-sharing platform Flatter, and the new German search engine Klix, it reflects Brad Burnham's vision of a new age of innovation being created from below by small, nimble companies unencumbered by legacy business models or technologies. A serial startup guy who sold his first business, a domain names company, in the late 90s, Schumacher was looking around for a new project when, in 2010, he stumbled on the Adblock Plus software, which he describes as an undiscovered gem. Originally created by a Moldovan engineer, the open-source technology was a volunteer-staffed, community-supported project without any business model. What it did, by hacking into browsers like Firefox or Chrome, was provide an advertising kill switch, replacing all adverts on websites with blank boxes. It turned the whole digital economy on its head. Rather than being perpetually watched and pestered by advertisers, the user now had the upper hand to block advertising, tracking, and cookie notifications, and even to disable those social media buttons that follow us around the Internet. Adblock Plus enabled the destruction of the web's dominant business model with the click of a mouse. Schumacher incorporated the company, raised 200,000 euros of seed money, and began to grow the business. In August 2011, it had 15 million users. By March 2016, its user base had grown to 100 million, making it by far the largest advertising blocking software company in the world. The market is now growing by 50% a year, and Schumacher expects to have a billion users by 2020, giving him an almost Facebook-sized community of users. Indeed, Adblock Plus has been so successful that even Google, the online advertising behemoth, has announced plans to build its own proprietary ad blocker into its Chrome browser in 2018. Germany might not have had a great first half in the digital game, but with products like Adblock Plus being used by a billion people around the world, its second half is turning out to be a lot more promising. Gazing out onto the spotless Cathedral Square, with its squadron of Polizei cars maintaining order, Schumacher tells me that by allowing people to eliminate all the crappy advertisements that trash up so many web pages, he is helping to clean up the Internet. Adblock Plus, then, can be thought of as a kind of digitally green solution to the digital pollution of our networked age. Schumacher tells me he is originally from Swabia, the southwestern region of Germany, famous for its extreme cleanliness. What he's doing with Adblock Plus, the entrepreneur thus suggests half seriously, he's re-engineering the Internet along Swabian lines. Certainly there's a desperate need to clean up an online advertising industry that Schumacher describes as lawless. Along with the disturbing surveillance issues associated with digital advertising, it's an industry increasingly corrupted by both false promises and outright fraud. The digital age of transparency is just as often an age of obfuscation, complains the British author and communications expert Ian Leslie, bemoaning the complete lack of accountability of online advertising. Instead of perfect precision, Robert Thompson, the CEO of the global media empire News Corp, complains about what he calls the digital duopoly of Facebook and Google. We have the cynical arbitraging of ambiguity, in which advertisers often end up unwittingly sponsoring hardcore porn, neo-fascist, and militant Islamist sites. A 2016 research report from the U.S. Association of National Advertisers, ANA, and White Ops predicted that almost 10%, $7.2 billion, of the $77 billion spent on online display ads that year would be invested in fraudulent products. Much of this fraud is made up of the use of bots, imitating the browsing habits of real people, thereby creating an industry in which, according to one study by the ANA, up to 37% of its supposed audience are actually zombies. Moreover, the online advertising industry, with its myriad layers of brokers and agencies, and its Byzantine systems for the automated buying and selling of ads, is, according to the Financial Times business columnist John Gapper, bafflingly complex. It's so complex, in fact, he says, that even regulators are failing to block fraudulent ads. So, rather than with the visible hand, the solution may lie in the invisible hand of the market, in the consumer demand for digital cleaning services, such as Adblock Plus, that, at the click of a mouse, banish the trash from our screens. Schumacher is perfectly serious when he claims that Adblock Plus is establishing a healthy new publishing ecosystem for the Internet. Many publishers, however, completely disagree, arguing that this ad-blocking product is actually destroying their advertising-supported businesses. Some, including Forbes, Wired, Business Insider, and most notably, Facebook, don't even allow Adblock Plus users access to their content. Six big German publishers, led by Springer, are even suing Adblock Plus, claiming that the software modifies websites and thus should be illegal under copyright law. When I talked to Mark Thompson, the New York Times CEO, he said he was hyper-hostile to ad-blocking software. He described Adblock Plus as a shit business, claiming that it's a new kind of protection racket that is intent on exploitation. What Thompson so strongly objects to is Adblock Plus's creation of a business model that requires larger publishers to pay in order to be included in a whitelist of acceptable ads. In Thompson's mind, the German company has become the Internet's latest gatekeeper and is using its new power to demand rent from large publishers like the New York Times. The disruptive success of Adblock Plus is certainly forcing Thompson to rethink his business. In June 2016, he confirmed that the Times would launch an advertising-free digital access option that would be priced higher than the regular subscription. But ad-blocking technology doesn't seem to have hurt the New York Times business model of selling subscriptions of its high-quality content. Since the election of Donald Trump in November 2016, the rate of sale of Times subscriptions is up more than tenfold, raising overall subscriptions to 2.5 million subscribers, adding more than $30 million a year, and now meaning that subscriptions make up more than 60% of the company's revenue. Schumacher, however, argues that Adblock Plus is acting as a trustee of the consumer in empowering users to configure the platform. "We are establishing rules," he insists, "on a lawless industry." And along with these new rules, he's also trying to pioneer a new online publishing business ecosystem in his partnership with the Swedish micropayments site Flatter, a decentralized marketplace that brings together producers and consumers of content. The plan is to combine Adblock Plus with Flatter's 200,000 users and 30,000 publishers, thereby taking out the intermediary and enabling these consumers to directly fund advertising-free online content, particularly journalism. No, it's not Mark Thompson's iconic New York Times, with its fabulously enlightening content created by professional journalists and curated by teams of editors and fact-checkers. But it is a promising example of Brad Burnham's faith in the invisible hand of the free market to create digital innovation from below. Flatter was founded by Peter Sunde, the Swedish digital activist who had also co-founded the controversial network The Pirate Bay, the index of digital content operating on the BitTorrent peer-to-peer protocol that was, in truth, mostly a platform for the exchange of stolen goods. Sunde, Schumacher promises me with a sad smile, brings the passion of the convict to this partnership with Adblock Plus. This is no exaggeration. Sunde was imprisoned for a year in Sweden for allegedly assisting Pirate Bay users with infringement of copyright. So his partnership with Adblock Plus is an attempt to re-engineer a legal ecosystem for an online content industry that, in a previous life, he helped undermine. In my 2007 polemic, The Cult of the Amateur, I was extremely critical of the way in which peer-to-peer networks, like the Pirate Bay, were enabling the theft of online content and thus destroying the livelihood of musicians, photographers, writers, and filmmakers. And so over the years, Sunda and I had often been on opposite sides of the piracy debate, sometimes even personally clashing in discussions about the need for copyright law and the immorality of online piracy. But when I meet Peter Sunda for dinner in Copenhagen to discuss Flatter and his partnership with Adblock Plus, I discover that while he was busy trying to reinvent the Internet, he had also reinvented himself. No longer interested in even discussing the rights and wrongs of the Pirate Bay, Sunda tells me that his focus now is on rewarding creative people for their work and creating decentralized alternatives to Google and YouTube. We need sustainable funding for creative people, he says, to ensure that creative people are paid. Peter Sunda has learned from his youthful mistakes. Rather than participating in the killing of our culture, he is now working on its rebirth. It might have taken him a while to arrive at Moore's Law, but in his attempt to reinvent both himself and the Internet, he has become a valuable player on Team Human. Unsafe at any speed. At Europe's most prestigious tech gathering, the Digital Life Design, DLD conference in Munich, that same event, you'll remember, where the EU antitrust chief, Margrethe Vestager, confessed to being unconcerned about the fragmentation of the Internet, there was speculation about Germany's chances of winning the second half of the Industry 4.0 game to control today's Internet of Things. The discussion focused on how local players could barge their way onto the global Plattform Kapitalismus. But many of the American attendees at DLD, particularly those from Silicon Valley, remained pessimistic about Germany's ability to turn around its poor first-half performance. One investor from Sand Hill Road, the Palo Alto street adjacent to Stanford University, that has become a synonym for venture capital firms, told me that Germany lacked the angel investment networks and the cultural acceptance of failure to do digital successfully. Others complained about the conservative nature of German corporations, particularly the absence of a risk-taking ethic among senior executives. Above all, however, their critique focused on the local culture. Germans' tendency to look backward, to be focused on their complicated history rather than on the future, many Americans at DLD observed. Germans remain more preoccupied, the Sand Hill venture capitalist quipped, with fixing their past than with fixing their future. Others were even less charitable. The Germans make great cars, one brash young founder of a San Francisco-based AI startup told me over lunch in Munich. That's what they are good at. They just don't do startups. Some of this, of course, is true. Compared with Silicon Valley, German business culture is quite conservative. But what many of the Americans at DLD overlooked, especially the younger and brasher startup entrepreneurs, is that a historical perspective on the future often not only is wise, but also has significant economic value. The Union Square Ventures co-founder Brad Burnham, you'll remember, argued that we are in a new age of innovation that resembles 1995. But there is another 20th century year that might be equally valuable in terms of making sense of our 21st century future. That year is 1965. It was in 1965, of course, that Gordon Moore invented his eponymous law in an article titled Cramming More Components Onto Integrated Circuits, first published in a special Electronics Magazine issue dedicated to predicting the future. But in 1965, there wasn't much popular interest in technical white papers about integrated circuits. Back then, anyone interested in reading about new technology had bought a book that not only turned out to be the year's most influential work of nonfiction, but also changed an entire global industry. Written by Ralph Nader, the book was called Unsafe at Any Speed, The Designed-in Dangers of the American Automobile, and just as Rachel Carson's 1962 bestseller Silent Spring dramatically raised public consciousness about the dangers of pesticides and toxic chemicals in our foods, so Nader's 1965 book did the same thing for the deadly dangers of American automobiles. The most interesting presentation at DLD was by a young German entrepreneur called Mark Alhamis, the co-CEO of Qlix, the new internet browser and search engine. Alhamis's speech, borrowing from Nader's 1965 bestseller, was titled Unsafe at Any Speed. The first slide Alhamis showed to the DLD audience was of a brand new two-door convertible red Corvair, a car manufactured by the American automobile company Chevrolet between 1960 and 1969. This was the car you wanted to have in 1965. It had a huge engine, incredible acceleration, lots of chrome. But there is only one problem about this car, Alhamis explained, referring to the gleaming Corvair, which was designed to be a combination of the Chevrolet's iconic Corvette and Bel Air models. That problem, Alhamis explained, is that it was unsafe at any speed. In the mid-50s, the big three American automakers, Ford, GM, and Chrysler, controlled 96% of the American market. As competition grew more intense, these car makers responded to a public appetite for automotive novelty, gadgetry, and space-age design with meretricious vehicles like the Chevrolet Corvair, which were designed to catch the eye and then wear out quickly. The goal, according to one industry executive, was to get consumers to buy a new car each year. Safety concerns became, at best, an afterthought. And these seat-beltless cars became little more than curvaceous, chrome-plated coffins. In 1961, the annual number of traffic fatalities in America was 38,000. In 1966, it had soared to 53,000, a shocking 38% increase in just 5 years. Then Nader, a young attorney at the time, published Unsafe at Any Speed, the most influential book ever written about car safety. A great problem of contemporary life, Nader wrote, is how to control the power of economic interests which ignore the harmful effects of their applied science and technology. The point of his book was to control those interests. His first chapter, The Sporty Corvair, The One Car Accident, exposed the Corvair's intrinsic suspension problem, which made the Chevrolet so incredibly dangerous to drive. The book detailed the gruesome flaws of the Corvair's design, such as its death trap of a steering wheel, which failed to collapse on impact, thereby impaling its drivers and subjecting them to the most gruesome death or disfigurement in an accident. And it accused Chevrolet of deliberately ignoring the connection between the car's ostentatious design and its absence of safety features. But the book was also a broader wake-up call about highway carnage that in 1964, Nader argues, was costing America an annual $8.3 billion, the equivalent of more than $66 billion today, in property damage, medical expenses, lost wages, and insurance overhead expenses. Unsafe at Any Speed was a public relations catastrophe for an American car industry that, in many ways, is only now recovering its mojo with Elon Musk's electric car startup, Tesla. The innovative Silicon Valley-based company that in April 2017 passed General Motors to become America's most valuable automobile manufacturer with a $52.7 billion market cap. Like the American food industry, the car market over the half-century since Nader published his exposé has been dramatically reshaped by our five-pronged forces of government regulation, competitive innovation, social responsibility by citizens, worker and consumer choice, and education. Nader's role as a concerned citizen educating the public about the dangers of the Corvair represented the beginning of a 50-year story that has resulted in a dramatic improvement of car safety in America. In 1965, when Unsafe at Any Speed was published, there were 5 deaths per 100 million miles traveled. By 2014, this number had dropped to one death, an astonishing 80% decrease in driving fatalities. How did this happen? Just as government regulation literally cleaned up the U.S. food industry, the same was true of the automotive industry. Nader's book led, in 1966, to the creation of the Highway Safety Act and the National Traffic and Motor Vehicle Safety Act. That same year, the Department of Transportation was created. These new government acts and the department set new safety standards, such as 1966 legislation mandating that all cars should have seatbelts. Subsequent legislation led to 17 other safety features, including requiring new vehicles to have padded seats and dashboards, and improving the locks on car doors. Between 1966 and the late 1980s, more than 86 million cars were recalled under the new federal rules. After New York and other states enacted their own seatbelt laws in the 1980s, seatbelt usage rose from between 3 and 10% in the 70s to 73% by 1994. Unfortunately, at least for Detroit, it was German car manufacturers who reinvented their products and marketing to satisfy a new consumer demand for safer vehicles. Daimler-Benz's safety cage, patented in 1951, offered a front and rear crumple zone that became a feature in Mercedes cars by 1959. Other innovations German manufacturers added to their cars after 1966 included windshields with safety glass, burst-proof locks for doors, shock-absorbent bumpers, anti-whiplash head restraints, and a collapsible steering column. In 1967, Volkswagen debuted electronic fuel injection, which dramatically lowered toxic emissions and reduced fuel consumption. In 1970, Daimler-Benz unveiled anti-lock braking on its cars. The overall result was a stunning shift in consumption patterns. From that 96% share of the domestic car market in the mid-50s, the big three of Chrysler, 13.2%, Ford, 15.6%, and General Motors, 17.1%, made up just over 45% of the U.S. market in 2017. Meanwhile, Americans are buying so many luxury German cars today that President Trump has threatened to slap a 35% tariff on the millions of cars, he claims, that are flooding into the United States from Germany. So let's fast forward half a century. What the hell, you are probably wondering, does a book about the 1965 Corvair have to do with a contemporary German internet browser and search engine? The connection, according to Al-Hamiz's DLD speech, is that both industries, the American automobile industry and the American internet industry, are unsafe at any speed. Of course, today's internet technologies aren't literally impaling their users. And yet, according to Al-Hamiz, Silicon Valley is at a stage similar to that of the car industry of the mid-60s, in terms of losing both the trust and the loyalty of its consumers. Echoing the arguments of digital pioneers like Tim Berners-Lee and Brewster Kahle, Al-Hamiz argues that only 50% of web pages are secure, that trackers spy on us on every web page, with 25% of the pages having more than 10 spies, that none of us have any idea where our data is going, and that 49% of users don't trust the internet. Like the Chevrolet Corvair, Al-Hamiz argues, the current internet, with its surveillance-style advertising-based ecosystem, isn't sustainable. This is what has led to the founding in 2015 of Clix, one of the most ambitious and well-financed digital media startups to have recently come out of Europe. Backed with tens of millions of euros in early-stage investment from Hubert Burda Media, the third-largest media company in Germany and the organizer of the DLD conference, Clix already employs more than 100 people, even though the company currently has no revenue model. Paul Bernhard Kallen, the innovative CEO of Burda, explained to me why Burda has invested so much time and money in Clix. Something seems to have gone wrong with the internet, he explained, when we met at DLD. Like so many other critics of today's networked society, Callan believes the central problem is the disappearance of trust, caused mostly, in his opinion, by too many people connecting too much data. Birda, he explained, has a moral responsibility, not just to make profits, but also to figure out ways that we can once again trust media. To do this, Callan explains, we need to rethink and reinvent search, the heart of the information economy. Created by Jean-Paul Schmetz, the former chief scientist at Birda, Clix is an innovative combination of search engine and internet browser, built on privacy by design principles. It's been engineered, or perhaps more exactly, re-engineered, as the anti-Google, an internet browser with an inbuilt search engine designed in such a way that it will never collect or sell its users' data. But, unlike the digital locker products introduced to me in London by the associates of Renata Sampson, Clix hasn't been created to take advantage of any new EU data legislation. The German startup believes that it can win purely through consumers choosing this superior product. That is to say, through the invisible hand of the market. Clix is ready to directly take on Silicon Valley leviathans, such as Google, because Mark Alhamis and Jean-Paul Schmetz believe their product is the best on the market, at least for a privacy-concerned user, which in truth means everyone inside and outside Germany. Indeed, given that President Trump signed an April 2017 bill repealing laws protecting the privacy of internet users, there may ultimately be more demand for a product like Clix in the United States than there is in Europe. Danelle Dixon Thayer, the chief legal and business officer at the Internet's third most popular Internet browser, Mozilla, after Microsoft's Internet Explorer and Google's Chrome, certainly thinks so. We love what they are doing, love that they are looking at alternatives for search, she told me when we spoke about Mozilla's strategic partnership with Clix. The business model of the web isn't broken, Dixon Thayer adds. We just need more transparency and honesty, which is where Clix comes in. We might not have invented the Internet, Alhamis concludes his DLD speech, sounding uncannily similar to Adblock Plus's Tim Schumacher. But if we clean it up and make it a better place every day. A few weeks later, when we meet for breakfast in Munich, I ask Alhamis the same question I'd ask Brad Burnham and Gary Reback about history repeating itself. Only this time I substitute 1965 for 1995. Alhamis, who is as energetic as he is thoughtful, nods vigorously at the similarities between 1965 and today. Silicon Valley is not remotely prepared for the future, he explains. Like those short-sighted Chevrolet executives in the 1960s, who believed they could continue forever to sell chrome-plated coffins to unsuspecting consumers, American tech companies just take it for granted that the current data ecosystem will remain intact. But the current system of tracking users, which has transformed the Internet into a giant inspection house, he insists, is out of control and eventually must change. Consumers simply don't want it. And just as Brad Burnham forecast a consumer rebellion against winner-take-all companies like Uber or Amazon that increase their take, so Alhamis believes we will eventually see a consumer rebellion against Silicon Valley's increasingly exploitative big data companies. That's what history teaches us about the future, he says. It's always a similar story with the same kind of ending. In 1965, Alhamis explains, who could have imagined a world where seatbelts were legally required, where cars were designed around increasingly sophisticated safety features, and where the number of deaths in the United States per 100 million miles traveled had been reduced by 80%? And, back in 1965, who could have imagined that Volkswagen, which had only just begun exporting its consumer-friendly Beetle into the U.S. market, would now have a billion-dollar production facility in Tennessee? Or that Chrysler, one of the big three automakers in 1965, would have filed for bankruptcy in 2009 and would now be owned by the troubled Italian car manufacturer, Fiat. Future generations, Alhamis says, will look back at our own time in similar disbelief. It will be the same way we look back at 1965 and are shocked by the vast majority of people who didn't wear a seatbelt while driving. In 50 years' time, he predicts, future generations will be equally horrified and amazed by the cavalier way in which our most personal information was revealed to unaccountable, opaque, multinational corporations headquartered on other continents. The data supports Al-Hamiz' argument. According to the Pew Research Center, 86% of American Internet users have taken steps to